Thank you for plugging into this Family Life News podcast, streaming issues-driven, family-focused news. Good afternoon and welcome to a very special edition of the Noon Report. I'm your host, Bob Price, and we're setting aside our regular programming today to share some stories of heroism. On this day, we recognize those who fought and died protecting our freedoms. We're also going to honor those fighting this invisible enemy in a war that we've all been thrust into the past couple of months, willingly or unwillingly. First off, let's separate fact from fiction when it comes to this plague we're dealing with. Our guest is a healthcare worker from Jamestown, New York, named Doug Justum. He's on the front lines of the COVID-19 fight and spoke recently to our own Bill Price. Here's some of their conversation.
What have you seen personally with this virus and the response to it?
What I've seen personally for the COVID is it's kind of different because you see a lot of what you consider is going to be COVID, and so you have to take precautions and things like that. Then you've got those that you don't know. It's like the unseen enemy, as was mentioned, where you think people are healthy. Maybe they came in with a broken finger or some totally unrelated issue. And then as they're in the hospital, you start to see the symptoms that are described.
Mm-hmm.
It became kind of scary for everybody because when somebody walked in the door, it would have been easy if they had never visited Africa and they didn't have a dry cough and they didn't have a fever, and then you could just rule that out.
Yeah.
And it turned out to be not the case at all. And one of the reasons that they've cut back on people coming in as visitors and things like that in hospitals too is because it's the same with families. Mm-hmm. People coming in totally with no symptoms at all, and they will test positive.
Do you feel, and you would know this more than most, do you fear that they are labeling a lot of these cases as COVID that aren't?
It's hard to say, only because we know that the testing procedure is not 100%. We would have been convinced that a lot of what we were seeing back in December and January was COVID, because they were very much like the COVID cases that you see. We all thought this from the very beginning. And now the governor even said it here in the past week or two that, it's been around a lot longer than anybody thought.
As we come up on Memorial Day and we think about those who have given their all for this country, who've served and who have fought a seen enemy, can you make any comparisons to that and this fight now against, as you said, this invisible enemy? And it's you guys, those in the health profession, you guys are now considered to be our war heroes against this invisible enemy. Can you make any comparisons to what we fought in years past and to what we're fighting right now?
Probably, since I'm in my 60s, I've seen, even though I'm not a veteran, I have seen what happens in wars, with the people. And, and I've talked to a lot of my friends were Vietnam veterans. And, when you'd sit down and talk to them, it was hard in some cases because it was difficult to tell the difference between, in some cases, South Vietnamese, North Vietnamese, whatever. But, they at least knew what the enemy looked like in some respects. With us going into this, the hardest part is, they say, you just don't know who's going to be carrying this. Mm-hmm. I can tell you that when it first came down and we were getting the reports from New York City, everybody was afraid.
Mm-hmm.
And so I can only imagine, as a war veteran, you don't want to cry, you don't want to admit that you're afraid and things like that. But just knowing that somebody could come in and totally change your life with not even meaning to. And the same with the war veterans. You never knew whether that next Jeep ride or whether that next hike or whatever they were doing mm-hmm. was going to completely change their lives, whether it impacted them directly or whether it was their friends or their family or things like that. And then that's mm-hmm. the same with this. It was mm-hmm. it was very, I'm not saying that we take it lightly now, but we'd know a little bit more about it.
Now, do you feel like you've had enough protective equipment? You felt like you, when you went to work, you were safe?
Yes, I felt safe going to work.
And there, as far as locally, there were never any concerns about people that needed care not being able to get that care?
No. As far as I know, you know, that was never the case.
Yeah.
We just didn't get the numbers. So, you know, whenever they talked about needing all the respirators and things like that, mm-hmm. that was never, ever the case here.
When you go through crisis, whether it be 9/11 or, you know, in World War II, the nation kind of came together, pitched in, helped out. It seems there is this rallying cry every time crisis unfolds. And I don't think we've ever seen anything like this ever before. A microscopic organism has pretty much shut down not just the U.S., but the entire world. Can you talk, Doug, about how we as a society, just we come together in times of crisis with donating things, whether it be ventilators, face masks, protective gear, stuff that we're seeing now. If there is one silver lining in all of this, it's the nation's response to this crisis.
Absolutely. And we all knew coming into this, there's going to be something good coming out of this, you know, and it just kind of goes back to, you know, whenever they were, you know, the astronauts were going up all the time, and there were so many things came out of the space program, even though it didn't make any sense at the time for a lot of people and why we were doing this. So kind of in the same respect here, they're learning a lot about how to quickly respond, properly respond, because obviously there's been a lot of improper responses, as we mm-hmm. talked about. But it's one of those things where the nation is just kind of gathering the good. They're gleaning what good they can out of this. The gathering together also is like they're recognizing, and I don't want to say the heroes because I never considered myself a hero, but they recognize the people that are really on the front lines and dealing with maybe more stress than other ones. So there's a lot of people recognizing it, and it's not just healthcare workers. You know, they're recognizing the people that are working in the grocery stores or you know, the gas station or, you know, wherever else, delivery people getting, you know, their packages and their mail. So, you know, it's kind of nice to see the nation recognizing people that really are putting themselves out there. They've got a job to do, and they decide, you know what, every morning I'm deciding whether or not I'm going to go to work today.
Yeah.
And these people are doing it.
Well, the big question now is, when do we get back to normal, or at least some sense of what we were before? And there's those who think that we should just kind of stay at home and wait this thing out some more. Others feel that it's time, it's go time, you know, that we can hide in our homes
right.
forever. And this is here. The virus is here. We've got to learn to adapt and to live with it. Do you have any opinions, Doug, as far as when we can and when we should get back to normal?
Things do have to get back. People have to start meeting face-to-face and things like that. And I just saw, I'm from Pittsburgh, and so I just saw where UPMC is saying, you know, it's time to get life moving again here. It's not that everybody takes the masks off and goes back to 100%, but, you know, they realize that you just can't live in a bubble.
Yeah.
So it's time to get back to real life.
Time to get back to real life. That's Jamestown, New York's Doug Justum, a healthcare worker on the front lines of the COVID-19 pandemic. If you're just joining us, we've set aside our regular programming this Memorial Day to bring you a special edition of the Noon Report. Our next guest is Frank Blazich. He's the curator of the National Museum of American History on the Mall in Washington, D.C. Blazich tells Family Life's Tracy Lynn that World War II was much different than the current war on terrorism. Take a listen.
What has the war on terrorism personally cost you? Have you had to experience rationing?
No.
Have you been urged to buy war bonds? Have you had to make sacrifices in your material welfare?
No.
Are you working extra hours? Are you saving more money? Are you saving your money because there's nothing to purchase?
Yes.
Okay, there we go. Are there simple things most Americans might say toilet paper, for example. But the point is, the Second World War for Americans was probably really the closest thing to total war since the American Civil War. And even there, I would say if the impact was on more states rather than others. But essentially, World War II really required an entire mobilization of the nation's resources, its material resources, its personal resources in terms of people, the financial resources of the country, its intellectual resources, spiritual and moral, and so forth. Conflict to Americans, we've been engaged essentially in open war since 2001, September 11, 2001. But what impact has that conflict really had on a deep level to Americans? Essentially, extremely little. Very few Americans have directly been impacted by the war on terrorism. The percentage of Americans that has actually served in uniform or served as civilian war fighters or as civilian contractors is very, very small statistical percentage. In the Second World War, you'll see 16 million men and women serve in uniform in the armed services. You'll have a vast number of Americans serving in some immediate war industry, some kind of manufacturing job, perhaps a service job, but something that directly ties into the war effort, either producing supplies, munitions, armaments for the conflict, not just for the Americans, but for our allies, or perhaps they're in some supporting role for those individuals working in those industries, those factories. My grandfather actually ran the cafeterias for Republic Aviation in Long Island, which was producing the P-47 Thunderbolt, among other aircraft. So there's an example where he's in the war industry, right, but he's supporting the people actually in the factories building the aircraft. Children would literally scrape aluminum from the back of candy wrappers for scrap drives. We had scrap drives. We think of, you drive along a street or a highway, you might see garbage on the side of the road. One could argue we were probably cleaner in World War II than any other time because all of that, what we consider garbage, could be reused for the war effort. Literally, people flew across the country and volunteer organizations like the Civil Air Patrol looking for scrap piles of old rusted cars, rusty metal that could be then put into the war effort. Captured German guns from the First World War at American Legion posts were taken into scrap drives and melted down. The rails of the Transcontinental Railroad, the sections that had been abandoned, they were actually torn up and thrown into the scrap drives to help support the war effort. It's a very different time in the country. And in many ways, we're losing that perspective of what it really is to commit to a fight. And this in a country that historically did not have nor support a large standing military. So our military post-World War II is essentially an aberration in the long arc of American history, where you have this extended Cold War, where we're going to see masses of investment in all branches of the armed forces, as well as the new branch, the independent United States Air Force. Today, we do have a Space Force recently established, and there's still the legacy of the Cold War, which is a World War II legacy of a standing military, which now consumes something like 2/3 of the federal budget. Yes. So of all this being said, one comes back to, well, what does VE Day matter? What does it mean? And one could say, well, will we see something equivalent for the war on terrorism? And if so, will we even ask about it? Or will we even remember it, for that matter?
I appreciate that. So we just celebrated VE Day. And when I think about how things would be different in our culture now, if the Nazis had won World War II.
I think Amazon has a program about that. It's called Man in the High Castle.
Yes. I actually have been doing a lot of watching of Foyle's War. I don't know if you've seen that. So all those things you just talked about where the kids finding the scraps, all of that was involved. Also, another angle was for the African Americans involved at that time during World War II. I'm not sure how accurate this is, but they showed that many of them were serving, but they couldn't actually be involved in battle.
It's, an interesting tie-in to VE Day. This is true. The African Americans in the Second World War were in segregated units. Training was segregated from that of white or non-African American personnel. If you'll understand, when we say white, Japanese Americans, they are segregated. Chinese Americans were not. Korean Americans were not. Native Americans were, for all intents and purposes, classified as white, as well as Arab Americans. They were able to serve with the designator as white and be integrated. African Americans were segregated and essentially denied an opportunity to demonstrate their capabilities in combat. But one of the interesting cracks in this whole story, occurs as a result of the Battle of the Bulge in December of 1944, where Americans and Allied forces are essentially caught off guard by the German army in their last great push in the West. The losses are going to be so substantial in killed and wounded among American forces that African-American units are by default kind of brought up, and in some cases personnel are integrated into white infantry units. And what we discover is they're absolutely perfectly capable of fighting, conducting themselves professionally, demonstrating combat prowess. Something that they themselves have been saying literally since the Revolution, but which institutionalized racism in the United States had continued to deny them an opportunity to serve. The end result, though, is even though they've demonstrated these examples in late 44, early 45, it's still going to require a presidential order in 1948 by President Truman to desegregate the military. And it will require a second, well, technically third, I guess, conflict we're talking about here, the Korean War, for integration to really take place widespread in the United States Army.
Well, thank you for sharing that perspective. So, Frank, what can we take away from the soldiers that have gone before us? We look back and we remember them, but we also move forward. What can we take away?
I think one of the most important things, particularly as we look now in our society where there's a lot of division, we're very divided. It could be by race. It could be by political affiliation, religion, language, state, hometown, any number of features. But what we see out of the Second World War is, despite differences, the nation is able to unite behind a common purpose, and people from all disparate walks of life in the country will take part in this. Many will lose their lives. Many will have their lives uprooted and transformed, both for good or worse. But afterwards, the focus is on let's get back to the business of living, and let's get back to making a life for ourselves and for our country, not necessarily looking at it as an us versus them, but rather I have played a small part in something much larger than myself, that I'm grateful for it, and that if I can continue to contribute, I wish to do so. That, of course, isn't universal for all 16-plus million who served in uniform and the countless millions of others who contributed to the war effort, but I think as a whole, that rings true to this day. And it's, I think, what any veteran would probably agree to. They played their part, and they wish to contribute to the betterment of society in their civilian capacity in whichever way that they can.
Say there's a young person, maybe a high school or middle school student. Are there some books or biographies that you would recommend? I think it's always fun for us to learn from others.
Well, for those who particularly want a greater insight, say, to the war in Europe, I highly recommend author Rick Atkinson wrote a three-volume series called The Liberation Trilogy. And it looks at basically the U.S. Army, and as well as the Navy and the Army Air Forces, that will fight in Europe. And he covers it all the way from North Africa in November of 42, all the way up to the surrender in Europe in 1945. It's highly recommended. I believe you can get it practically in every single format imaginable. A book that really affected me as a young person that I had the opportunity to read is by a man who was called America's most decorated soldier of World War II. Audie Leon Murphy received every decoration for valor this country had to offer. And in 1949, his autobiography, To Hell and Back, was published and became an immediate bestseller. Audie is in many ways a man made by the war, and yet at the same token, profoundly altered by the war internally, emotionally. Murphy is 17. He actually has his sister forge a statement saying he's 18 years old to fight. And he'll end up fighting in North Africa, Italy, as well as in France, and until the surrender. The book ended up being made into a movie in 1955 called To Hell and Back, starring Audie Murphy himself. And it's very accessible for young people. It's not a book celebrating war, but it's definitely a book that will cause people to better understand just how terrible war is. For those interested in the conflict in the Pacific War, I highly recommend the autobiography of Eugene Sledge, called With the Old Breed. And Eugene Sledge is a man born in the South to a family of comfort, we will just say financially, who will enlist as a Marine, and he'll end up fighting on the island of Peleliu, as well as Okinawa, in some of the most ferocious, savage fighting that the Marines encounter in the Second World War. Much like Murphy, Sledge is deeply affected by the conflict emotionally, and it's something that really stays with him to the end of his life. But he's able to capture in words kind of the savage ferocity of war and just how horrible it really is, and the effect it has on the human character For those familiar with the HBO miniseries, The Pacific, he is one of the characters that the viewers follow along in the film, but perhaps those are unaware that it's actually based off a book. It's considered a classic of the genre and is accessible in many different forms.
That's Frank Blazich. He's the curator of the National Museum of American History in our nation's capital. If you're just joining us, this is a special Memorial Day edition of the Noon Report, and we're wrapping up today's broadcast spotlighting the struggles veterans face today. These struggles continue years after they return home from active duty. Family Life's Brandon Dixon is talking with Jennifer Haggerty. She's a suicide prevention coordinator at the VA in Bath, New York.
How does a health crisis like what we're seeing globally affect a veteran's mental health?
The COVID-19 pandemic has the potential to increase stress and anxiety because of the fear of catching the virus and of uncertainty about how the outbreak will impact us, both socially and financially. Social distancing guidelines, which are aimed at decreasing exposure, can and may lead to a sense of detachment and isolation, often feelings of sadness and disappointment. So our veterans who struggle with depression, anxiety, or trauma-related symptoms can experience an increase in frequency or intensity of these symptoms as stress related to the pandemic surfaces. They may experience concerns about safety, feeling unable to cope, some helplessness, guilt, or even anger. Feeling on edge, worrying, difficulty with sleep are often common complaints, as essentially our stress response in our bodies, our fight or flight system, is activated. So although veterans may feel as if they are experiencing increased instability, in actuality they're not. Rather, they are coping with a new reality, which is incredibly stressful. Importantly, we know that when faced with personal and collective distressing events, such as this pandemic, people are and can be incredibly resilient and can effectively cope if they engage in strategies aimed at decreasing stress and increasing a sense of safety and control. These strategies are what we at VA are working diligently to provide to our veterans, and we're using a lot of very innovative and creative modalities to do so.
For those vets out there, or maybe even their caregivers, what tips or advice would you recommend so that they can better cope with the stress of a pandemic like this?
There's so many things at our fingertips right now. There's so many things that the VA is doing. There's so many things on the internet. And we'll discuss some of those. But first and foremost, I just really want to stress the importance of just taking a deep breath. Just breathe. Try to stick to as normal of a routine as possible. Humans are creatures of structure and habit. I personally like to try to spend every morning doing what I call waking with intention for the day, rather than just going on autopilot. That can be a huge benefit to getting through difficult times. Set small attainable goals for yourself throughout the day that can include getting a bit of fresh air, 30 minutes of physical activity, really trying to touch base with someone that you care about to assist with offsetting some of the natural isolation that occurs during social and physical distancing. And I think most importantly, just really be nice to yourself. Give yourself a break for how you're feeling. This is a very difficult time, and you're not alone in your struggles. Secondarily, you know, the VA continues to provide ongoing care and services to our veterans during this pandemic. Each department's adjusted their ability to provide contact-free care and are available to assist you with any questions that you may have. So it's important to ensure that you're keeping up with your physical and mental health by keeping any appointments that you may have had scheduled. Support groups and services are still operating via VA Video Connect and other platforms. We're getting very creative and innovative on how to still be able to have regular contact with our veterans if they're not able to come into the facility. And it can be stressful because a lot of people have not used these modalities before. But we have individuals who are very well trained that can walk people through step by step what they need to do to be able to connect through video or through phone. I personally have some veterans that I worked with, one in particular who was very fearful of doing the group by phone. And with a lot of support and encouragement, they were able to connect with us through a phone group. And by the end of the group, was so happy to report that it went well, that she was very surprised at how easy it was to be able to receive her care in that way, and that it had really helped with decreasing some of the symptoms she was having from so much isolation. We also have, for people who are struggling with access to food or just being able to get out of the house to get to stores, there's a great food box project that's going on right now. VA has partnered with the Food Bank of Southern Tier. The boxes are put together at Corning High School by Corning Inc. employees and teachers. VA picks up 216 boxes per week. They contain different food pantry staples to feed a family of four for about 4 days. We've been delivering to veterans who are in our homeless program, elderly, disabled, have children in the home, have a compromised immunity or lack transportation. And even if you don't qualify for VA services, we're still here to assist you in finding resources that can suit your needs. I think that's really important for our veterans and their family members to realize that some don't qualify for VA healthcare, but we can still assist you with finding resources that suit what it is that you're struggling with.
One of the many unfortunate parts of this pandemic is that a lot of events have been canceled, and that means a lot of Memorial Day events, times in which we could support our local veterans, celebrate them, acknowledge their efforts as well. So with that in mind, that most of the public events are now canceled, how can we support or encourage veterans in other ways?
I think it's really just important for everyone to be knowledgeable about resources that are available to our veterans, such as a lot of the ones that we just discussed, because you can guide a veteran that you know to those resources and help them link to those resources. Keep an eye on our Facebook page for information and new events on how you can assist in honoring our veterans. You can call your local VA and ask to speak to voluntary services. They're very well versed in how you can volunteer your time. But most importantly, just be there. We have a saying at the VA, hashtag be there. It makes a huge difference. When you're home alone all day, just hearing from someone, just touching base with them to say hello, ask them how they're doing. Sometimes just hearing from someone who cares can play a pivotal role in someone's mood and how the rest of their day is going to go. Secondarily, VA will also be launching a new way for the public to pay tributes to veterans at the Veterans Legacy Memorial. The site originally launched in 2019. It contains a memorial page for each veteran and service member. So that's very exciting to me. I think that that's just wonderful. And this is all just in relation to the pandemic. So I anticipate that as we move forward, we're going to just continue to find even newer and more innovative ways to be able to celebrate holidays like these.
Anything our listeners or our veterans should know or that you would like to put out there for them?
I just can't stress enough in my role as suicide prevention coordinator, we're all about prevention. And that covers so many things. We have our Veterans Crisis Line that people can call when they're struggling. And a lot of people hesitate to call because they think, well, what is a crisis? A crisis is anything that is causing you to have internal struggles or external struggles. Don't be afraid to call for help. There are so many things that we can assist you with, whether you belong to VA or not. You are not alone. There are so many people that struggle with so many things, and anything that we can do at VA to assist you in alleviating those stressors, we will do at our best to serve you. It's been been an honor for me in this position to be able to serve those who have served. And there's just been no greater good for me in my life. It's just been an honor and a pleasure. And it's things like this, these interviews and people like you in this station that have these interviews and do these things to get news out there, get information out there, so that we can all continue to support one another in the best way that we can. So I thank you for that. And I thank all of our veterans for their service.
And that brings us to the end of this special edition of the Noon Report, a Memorial Day edition. Our thanks to Family Life's Bill Price, Tracy Lynn, and Brandon Dixon for their part in compiling today's broadcast. We'd like to thank as well our guests today, Jennifer Haggerty, the Suicide Prevention Coordinator at the Bath VA, Frank Blazich, Curator of the National Museum of American History, and Doug Justin from Jamestown, New York, a nurse on the front lines of the coronavirus fight. And thank you for being with us. Enjoy the rest of your Memorial Day holiday. I'm Bob Price. Family Life News.